He's not a secretary.
So we'll take the 67 first.
I'm not his friggin' secretary. Get a clue.
Ready?
Do it.
All right. House Committee on Revenue will come to order. We'll open a public hearing on House Bill 4067. Chris, do you want to describe the bill for us? And then Representative Gomberg.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 4067 would modify the preferential tax rates applied to non-passive income. It creates one preferential tax bracket of up to $250,000 and uses a tax rate of 7%. It also makes a couple of changes to the eligibility requirements pertaining to work hours of work. It would reduce the aggregate total of 1,200 down to 1,000 and the weekly threshold from 30 to 20. And these changes would apply beginning with tax year 2016. The bill also moves the sunset date for the manufacturing business energy tax credit from January 1, 2014, so it's already sunset, to January 1, 2020, the standard six-year extension.
Okay. Yes, sir. Good morning.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. For the record, David Gomberg from House District 10 on the Central Oregon Coast. Thank you for rescheduling this measure for this morning. I appreciate this opportunity to share an overview with you. During the recent special session, we passed tax reductions for 78,000 Oregon S corporations and LLCs. My proposal before you today is to expand that program by 10%, adding roughly 7,800 more small businesses that would benefit from lower taxes. This bill will accomplish that goal by leaving 99.6% of tax filers who benefited from our recent changes unaffected. The proposal is virtually revenue neutral. And finally, I'm advocating for predictability and stability in this tax program. Please note that my comments today include the Dash 1 amendments, which raise the threshold for the top bracket to $1 million. And I also want to thank Legislative Revenue for providing me with the numbers that I'm sharing with you today. I'd like to talk, first of all, about expanding the program. The measure that we passed requires qualifying companies to have full-time, year-round employees. That doesn't work very well for many seasonal and small businesses. It doesn't work well in rural economies. In short, it doesn't work very well in my district and in many of yours. So I'm proposing today that this qualifying requirement be reduced to include employers of part-time employees. This change would benefit roughly 7,800 more businesses in fishing, farming, dairy, ranching, and tourism statewide. It would add smaller firms that are in a critical growth stage, and it would add companies that hire part-time working seniors and working parents. These 7,800 companies would cost an additional $7 million. That's an average savings of $900 per tax filer. I think that's a significant number, especially when you consider that under the current measure that we recently passed, half of the tax filers receive only a $140 benefit. So I'm talking about $900 for these 7,800 new companies versus $140 for half of the companies that previously qualified. So we're adding more companies, 10% more, and we're providing them with a more significant and more meaningful level of relief. But this, of course, begs the question of how do we pay for this change and keep the measure as revenue neutral as possible. My amendment would limit the tax break to the first $1 million of taxable profit. That's taxable profit over and above any salaries that company owners may be paying themselves. What that means is that taxpayers with less than $1 million of qualifying income see no change whatsoever, and those who net over $1 million will still receive a $35,500 tax break. This limit would affect only 250 out of 78,000 firms. So please let me be clear again that 99.6 of the businesses benefited during the recent special session would see no change at all. And the small percentage who do see a change are still receiving a significant benefit of $35,500 when previously they were receiving an average of $41,000. Said another way, my bill will help an average of 130 additional small businesses in each of our districts. 1,300 more would get what they already have, and four would be limited to a mere $35,000 tax break. The difference would be $8 to $10 million in revenue, very close to the projected $7 million cost of my measure. And given the preliminary nature of these numbers, legislative revenue describes this as a fairly neutral exchange. I've spoken before to this committee about predictability and stability in public policy, and I've expressed concerns that the open-ended nature of our recent legislation would encourage firms to change their tax status to seek out savings. Now, there's nothing at all wrong with them doing that. The problem is that we don't know how many firms will shift or what the effect on revenue will be. Capping the break at $1 million will benefit firms that presently qualify without providing a major incentive for other companies to reclassify. Now, Mr. Chairman, I want to make it clear. I've got no problem at all with businesses that make money. I've got nothing but respect and admiration and, frankly, a little bit of envy for them. Oregon needs big business. We should remember, though, that many big businesses started out as small ones. I think we can agree that our investment in Oregon's smallest growing firms will make a real difference. I've been asked why I've introduced this bill so soon after the special session. One answer is that I think it's never too soon to make improvements. But the deeper reason is this. I'm a small business guy. Nothing makes small business crazier than constantly changing rules. I don't want to implement the recent changes and then change them again later. I want to offer small business a complete package when all of this goes into effect. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my own company started out with a sheet of plywood across the washing machine for a shipping department. Intel started on a kitchen table. Nike began selling shoes from the trunk of Phil Knight's car. Out there in Oregon right now, there are people investing their experience, their creativity, their economic courage to try and make something out of nothing. They dream of being the next Leatherman or Columbia Sportswear or Rogue Brewing, and I believe Oregon would be better off if they succeed. That's why I'm before you today and asking you to move this measure to the House with a due pass recommendation. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you very much. Questions for Representative Gomberg? Representative, do we have your amendment? We haven't been able to find it. Would you see that it gets to us?
Absolutely, Mr. Chairman. I submitted the Dash 1 amendments. You're saying they're not in OLIS?
I don't see it.
We haven't seen it.
All right. I will make sure you have that before this committee adjourns.
Thank you. And we'll ask the staff to see that it's posted in OLIS. Then once we get it.
All right. Well, the amendments simply changed the cap from the $250,000 in the original draft to $1 million. And the reason was quite simply that as you well know the process, we create a draft and then we determine the numbers that go with that draft. And once I saw the numbers, it was clear that I could accomplish the goals of this measure and raise the cap higher so that only 1/3 of 1% of the previously affected companies would be capped, and everybody else would be getting exactly what they're getting right now.
Okay. What's your estimate of that in numbers? How many businesses?
Legislative revenue indicates that this would increase the total number of companies affected by 10%. That would be about another 7,800 companies throughout the state.
And the number that would be reduced, that would have a lesser amount of benefit at the top end?
Yes, Mr. Chairman. That's 250 companies statewide, or roughly 1/3 of 1% of the current qualifying companies. Right. And they wouldn't be eliminated from any tax break. They would simply be capped out at $35,500 in tax reductions over and above any salaries that the owners of those companies may be paying themselves.
Instead of what the current bill does, or the current law does?
The current law indicates that the average in that category would be $41,000 in tax breaks. So I'm capping it at $35,500 when the previous average was
$41,000. Okay. And we went through this stuff very quickly, and I suspect you understand this very well because you've been working hard on it since then, and since October. We're not talking about a break per company, are we? We're talking about a break per taxpayer, if I understand correctly.
That's correct,
Mr. Chairman. So if there are several principals in a business, the business nets $20 million after all expenses, and there are four principals. Under the current law, each one of them could take $5 million worth of under this current statute that you're wanting to amend?
That's correct, Mr. Chairman. Again, companies will have more than one owner. They'll pay themselves a salary, and then the additional profits of the company, after all costs, would be subject to the measure that we previously passed, and I'm looking at capping that at $1 million so that they'd receive an additional $35,500 per tax filer. The issue for me back home is, next door to my store, I've got two mom and pops. Mm-hmm. The owners of those companies don't qualify for any break because principals don't qualify for the break. These stores each have part-time employees. I go home after the recent special session, and they say to me, you passed a tax break for small business. What do I get? And the answer to that is absolutely nothing, yeah, because you've got part-time employees.
Oh, sorry. Representative Benz, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative, I appreciate your thoughtfulness. But this appears to be part of the so-called grand bargain that just happened a few short months ago. Am I right?
That's correct, Representative, Mr. Chairman.
And follow up, Mr. Chair.
Yes, please.
And I'm guessing that almost everybody that took part in that exercise would want to modify some part of it. Just guessing. But when I went home, there were lots of comments about all kinds of different parts of it. And one might say that if it was a grand bargain, one would have thought it would have lasted longer than just 4 short months. At least most people would.
Okay, we'll
so how do you justify bringing this little piece when there are probably innumerable changes people might want to work upon the grand bargain?
Have we heard from Bailey?
At what point does the ball of yarn stop unraveling and we don't have any grand bargain at all? We just have nothing. So what? Explain to me, does any other part of it deserve less attention than that which you're giving this piece?
Well, and, Mr. Chairman, Representative Benz, thank you for the question, and I do understand your point. I don't believe this measure is going to unravel so that we eventually have nothing. I'm unraveling, if that would be the phrase, one-third of 1% of it to try and benefit nearly 8,000 more small companies, small companies that I believe are in a critical stage of their development. If you have part-time employees, it's largely because you'd like to have full-time employees and can't afford them yet. So I brought these proposals, and the timing of my proposals is so that when we implement this tax package, that it will be implemented with these amendments rather than coming back later and making additional changes so that small businesses and their accountants sit down and figure out what their tax rates are this year and then find out that those rates have changed again for the following year. I think that the purpose of the short session is to fine-tune recent legislation, identify problems, and correct them. I think this is an appropriate time to make this relatively small change, a small change that affects one-third of 1% of the companies that are covered by this and brings a large and meaningful number of more companies into it.
Thank you.
Bill.
Okay, great, thanks. Thank you. Other questions for Representative Gomberg? Thank you. Very much appreciate your testimony in bringing the bill. We have two other witnesses who asked to be heard this morning, J.L. Wilson and Jan Meekums, please. Good morning.
Good morning. Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. For the record, J.L. Wilson with Associated Oregon Industries. We would certainly oppose House Bill 4067 as written. I do appreciate Representative Gomberg's dash one amendment, because I, at the end of the day, I think that is a legitimate policy discussion. But as I've told, and everything I'm telling you is the same thing I've told Representative Gomberg, the timing just couldn't be worse. The reason being, you know, to get engaged in the grand bargain, we had to convince a bunch of members that a tax increase was good for them. We had to convince a bunch of members that the state needed more revenue despite general fund increasing 10% or more. And we had to convince a bunch of members to overcome a healthy skepticism that the legislature would keep the bargain intact. And I have to say, and again, I told this to Representative Gomberg, when news broke that that bill, the 4067, had been introduced, I got so many I told you so's, I stopped counting. And so I think the dash one is a legitimate policy discussion. I would submit to you the timing is just terrible. The small business tax cut doesn't take effect until January 1, 2015. And if the parties want to rediscuss that, they're, but I would submit that now is just not the right time. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Michael Brown here. Would you come forward, please? Is there anyone else who wants to be heard on this bill this morning? Please, go ahead.
Thank you, Chair Barnhart and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Jan Meekums, the State Director of NFIB, National Federation of Independent Business. We have about 7,500 small independent businesses across the state in every venue imaginable, from self-employed all the way to companies that have several hundred employees. We also, I would have to say that JL communicated quite deftly one of the issues we have, that our members, that we feel this was a very arduous negotiation in the grand bargain, and we had to really go to task with our members and present this, and it was quite a feat to get them on board and feeling comfortable and acceptable of the grand bargain. And we too did receive I Told You So. And although it's a very thoughtful, I know a lot went into this bill, we appreciate Representative Gomberg's effort. We certainly are willing to talk about it. The amendment does make a big difference. The hourly change that is brought forward that would increase more small businesses that are more seasonable, we would certainly not have a problem with that. But what our members want is certainty. And this is probably one of the most uncertain times for businesses, especially small business, and with what's going on in healthcare and at the federal level and at the state level. And one thing that this bill, as it was passed, did provide our members was some certainty regarding their tax options. This bill takes that away. And so for that reason, at this point in time, we cannot support House Bill 4067.
Thank you. Yes, sir.
Mr. Chairman, I'm Michael Brown. I'm an attorney. I'm a father. I'm a businessman. I'm a Democrat. And I used to be a good friend of Representative Gomberg back when we both had our same color hair.
Not anymore, huh?
I consider him a
friend. I shouldn't say that.
And he's a good guy.
I apologize.
I appreciate what's been said, that this may even be a good measure. I don't know the specifics of the measure. I just know that it's not time to change the deal. The timing is bad. As a lawyer, there's a principle called stare decisis. I think it's Latin for already decided. And I know it's a principle that says once a big court, like a Supreme Court, has made a big decision, you don't change it unless there's a huge reason to overcome stare decisis. I know as a parent, it's important to have stability in the children. And even if one parent in a divorce changes and becomes better than the other, you don't change custody, because it's a big deal to change custody. And I know as a business person, just don't move the goalposts. Just stop. Take a breath. Let us at least get used to the laws that you passed before you start changing them. Change is always painful, but this change at this time, maybe any change in the grand bargain, just really unwinds things. And finally, as a Democrat, the deals are made, and everything in that bill will have something that some party wants to change. But I get frustrated with Republicans who criticize Democrats unfairly. But if this deal changes, that'll be a fair criticism, and we just don't need that.
Thank you very much. Questions for this panel? Thank you. Very much appreciate your testimony. I will note that the Dash 1 amendment has been posted, and we'll simply note that for the record. And with that, we'll close the public hearing on House Bill 4067. Yes, and it's my intention, since all committee members are here now, to go to the work sessions and then come back to our public hearing agenda. Are you on any of these? On the work sessions?
I'm not on any of those.
You're not on any of those. Okay, we'll open the work session on House Bill 4148 and hear from Christine. I'll note that we have the Dash 2 amendment on that measure.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, yes, House Bill 4148 would change the interest rate for the senior and disabled property tax deferral from 6% compound to 6% simple. It would apply this change to property tax years beginning after July 1st, 2016. The Dash 2 amendment was made to address the possibility that a person may pay part of their balance before that July 1st, 2016 date and then part of their balance after that date. So it refers to balances due after July 1st, 2016 or still outstanding and makes those as though they had 6% simple interest all the way back to 2011 when the change was first made. The measure has a revenue impact of doesn't take effect until 2016. Then it is negative $650,000 in 2015-17 and negative $850,000 in 2017-19. Below in the revenue impact statement, you can see the projected balance in the program after these changes. There is a statement of generally no fiscal impact on this measure because it would be integrated with the change in the core system replacement for the Department of Revenue. It does note the possible risk that maybe the core system replacement wouldn't be done by that date, but John Phillips could speak to the possibility of that, probability of that versus having this change have no fiscal impact.
All right. Mr. Phillips?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. John Phillips of the Department of Revenue. And thank you for your patience with this Dash 2. I think it accomplishes the goal of the proponents that brought the bill before you, and that is to change the interest rate back to simple. And our challenge administratively was to maintain a simple, compound, and then simple, basically three scenarios where we would carry accounts forward with both compound and simple. And so this amendment, the Dash 2, actually allows us to make one system change going forward in 2016 with the new system and move everybody to simple at that point. So it sounds like a difficult language to read and understand, but I provided some testimony to it. I think that lays that out in how it accomplishes that goal.
And it dovetails with the core replacement process.
Yes, Mr. Chair. It's on schedule with our core systems replacement, and senior deferral is one of the, not the first program, but one of the early programs to be converted.
All right. No point in writing the program twice.
That's our thought. Yes, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Representative Berger?
Mr. Chair, I move the Dash 2 amendments to House Bill 4148.
Thank you. Representative Berger moves the Dash 2 amendments to House Bill 4148. Is there discussion?
Yes.
Yes, Representative Berger.
Members, it snowed all weekend, and John Phillips and Alan Dale worked on this all weekend. Okay. Fortunately, they could do it electronically, and I was in on the conversation. This is very difficult to write, and I think the proponents of this, and I'm one, I think we should do this, have to understand that with the timing of this and the core replacement, there's a lot more at stake than just a simple change. And there's going to be a little twilight zone, as Alan Dale puts it, in there between now and the time that we can, with the core system, fully implement a simple interest going back. And property transactions that fall in this twilight zone are going to be in a bit of a twilight zone that's going to take some special work by all parties. So I support this concept, and I support this bill fully, and I just hope you appreciate all the work. There is nothing about our simple property tax deferral program that is simple. And I just appreciate the folks that worked on this through the snowy weekend.
Except the interest now.
Thank you. Yeah. Other discussion on the Dash 2s? Any objection to the Dash 2s? Seeing no objection, the Dash 2 is adopted. Representative Berger?
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 4148 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Thank you. Representative Berger moves House Bill 4148 to the, as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion? Is there any objection? No objection. Motion carries. Bill goes to the floor. Representative Nathanson, will you carry? Representative Nathanson will carry the bill. And with that, we'll close the work session on House Bill 4148 and open a work session on House Bill 4142. Christine?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 4142 would change, make some changes to the definition of a rural area. There is a dash one amendment which would allow the size or a city of less than 40,000 to be considered a rural area for the purposes of the strategic investment program. That does incorporate a couple more cities. The investment requirement is that the investment be greater than $100 million in urban areas and $25 million in rural areas. And so the SIP program is a bit larger of an abatement for rural area. The measure is found to have no fiscal impact, and the revenue impact of the measure is a positive $1.99 million in 2013-15, $7.54 million in 2015-17, and $11.92 million in 2017-19.
And this is based on what?
This is based on if this change had been in place when some of the areas that are inside urban growth boundaries now and receiving rural SIP incentives, it would be the difference between the rural and the SIP and the urban SIP incentive for one of them, and the difference between participation and not participating in another. And then I applied that to the projected growth of the program. As a percentage going forward, and that's how that number was obtained.
Okay, and as I read the report, it doesn't affect the revenue to the state. It affects revenues to local taxing districts, counties, and schools. Is that right?
That is correct. There would be, to the extent that it might change business activity, there might be an effect to the state. But primarily it is considered property tax revenue.
Okay, thank you. Other questions for Christine? Oh, yeah, Representative Vega Peterson, please.
Yes, thank you. So, Christine, just to be clear about what the revenue impact statement is, it's as if
and the bill?
What was happening before hadn't been allowed.
I didn't know.
But not really the changes that are happening right now because we're grandfathering in what had happened before.
Correct, and it does not affect any existing exemption.
Okay.
Thank you.
All right. Representative Berger?
Yes, Mr. Chair, I move the dash one amendment to House Bill 4142.
Representative Berger moves the dash one amendment to House Bill 4142. You recall that changes the size of the cities affected from 30,000 to 40,000. Is there discussion of the amendment? Any objection to the amendment? Seeing none, the amendment's adopted. Representative Berger?
Yes, Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 4142 as amendment to the floor, as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Berger moves House Bill 4142 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion. Yes, Representative Gelser, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I've been in discussion with some folks in my community, and I'm really grateful to Representative Vega Peterson for accessing some more information for me. And I just wanted to clarify again that what we're talking about is acreage added into the urban growth boundary after this date. And could you say again for the record how many counties that impacts at this point in time?
Yes, thank you. So, Chair and Representative Gelser, there's only been two cities who have actually been impacted by the change since the 2002. One is the Metro Urban Growth Boundary, and the other is Bend. And actually, in Bend, it's under litigation right now, so there hasn't been an official addition to Bend. But all other urban growth boundaries, they actually haven't had an increase in any kind of acreage since 2002.
So today, if we pass this bill tomorrow for Albany and Corvallis, there would be no change whether we pass the bill or not in terms of their ability to access the rural SIP.
Yeah, that's correct.
Thank you.
Thank you. Further discussion, Representative Davis, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. First of all, I want to thank Representative Agapetersen for bringing the bill. In a vacuum, this bill looks great, but it's not in a vacuum. It is in the context of some cities, specifically Hillsborough and Bend. I will just speak to Hillsborough specifically because I don't represent the Bend area, who have successfully used the rural SIP program and would like to continue to use it. I don't think there's any reason that this bill couldn't include areas that they are planning on using it, but as designed, and if we move this bill to the floor and pass it, it would remove some areas that Hillsborough could use, and for that reason, I'm going to oppose it.
Thank you. Further discussion? And the motion before us is on...
Chair.
I'm sorry. Yes, Representative Benz, please.
I'm sorry, Mr. Chair. I'm going to vote for the bill today, but I must say this has taken way more thought than I thought it would. And
well, that happens here.
Yeah, it does. I would just say that the issue that's used, which is that this will benefit rural areas, is not necessarily meaningful for many of the ones I represent, because seldom does this make anything happen in the rural areas, at least mine. I wish it did. It doesn't work unless there's something else that's going to already happen, like the wind blows in a certain spot. Then, oddly enough, towers go up and the SIP is used. The SIP didn't have much to bring the wind there, and certainly not the towers that followed. But on the other hand, it seemed, in going back on the history of the thing, imprecise in how it was originally crafted. I truly understand Representative Davis's concern, and that's why I'm going to help it get to the floor, but I may change my mind later, Mr. Chair.
Thank you very much. Other discussion? Seeing none, I think we better call the roll. The motion is on sending this bill to the floor as amended with a due pass. Please.
Representative Benz.
Aye.
Representative Conger.
No.
Representative Davis.
No.
Representative Gelser.
Aye.
Representative Breed.
Aye.
Representative Vega Peterson.
Aye.
Vice Chair Bailey.
Aye.
Vice Chair Berger.
Aye.
Chair Barnhart.
Aye. The ayes have it, and the bill goes to the floor with a due pass. Representative Vega Peterson, will you carry the bill?
I will, thank you.
Representative Vega Peterson will carry. With that, we'll close the work session on House Bill 4142. We'll open a work session on House Bill 4039. And again, you're on.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 4039 would clarify that nonprofits who provide low-income housing services for low-income persons would continue to receive a tax exemption. Currently, they've been receiving the exemption under the Charitable Literary and Scientific Organization exemption, and there has been a court case recently that has been challenging that. It is currently moving to the Supreme Court. The bill would only allow those who had been granted this exemption for the property tax year beginning July 1st, 2012 to continue to receive this exemption. And there you have the Dash 1 amendment, which would, at a sunset of this exemption of July 1st, 2018, it's thought that perhaps changes could be made to some of the other low-income or nonprofit and low-income housing statutes and programs, and could be sorted out by 2018. The revenue impact is one of those ones where it depends on the outcome of the court case. And so the revenue impacts are either zero or negative $11 million in 2013-15, either zero or negative $8.36 million in 2015-17, or and zero or negative $4.43 million in 2017-19. And that depends on the outcome of the court case. It's assumed that these organizations make up 5% of that charitable, literary, and scientific organization tax exemption, which is strictly an assumption. There is no actual information about how many different organizations receive that, and the information is received in aggregate. The measure is found to have No fiscal impact. And so the statement of no fiscal impact is also in OLIS, along with the dash one amendment.
I'll carry it. Okay. Great. So we have pending a dash one amendment. Representative Berger?
Mr. Chair, I move the dash one amendment to House Bill 4039.
Thank you. Discussion of the dash one. I will simply note that the point of this bill, as I understand it now, is to put in abeyance whatever outcome this case might have for the people who are not directly litigants in the case. It does not moot the case. The point, of course, is that we want to know what the results are. But it also will obligate, if the case goes the way it might, that will obligate the legislature then to consider what to do next. My own not very expert evaluation of this area of the property tax law is that it needs some work, and this will encourage us to get it done in one of the long sessions. And if I read this correctly, we have two shots at it by this sunset date. Any other discussion on the dash one? Any objection to the dash one? All right, dash one is adopted. Representative Berger?
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 4039 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Thank you. Representative Berger moves House Bill 4039 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion? Any objection to the motion? I don't see any. With that, the motion passes. Representative Berger and I had an arm wrestling over who was going to carry the bill. She won, so Representative Berger will carry. And with that, we'll close the work session on House Bill 4039 and open up. Representative Parrish is here.
Yes, she is.
Yeah. And we'll open the public hearing on House Bill 4097. Is that the one?
She was here.
She was here.
She's in the hall.
Okay. $40.97.
She's coming in.
Okay. Great. Chris?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 4097 creates a tax subtraction and a tax credit related to student loan interest paid. There are limits. It applies to tax years 2015 through 2024. The tax credit is limited to education in Oregon institutions, and the credit is focused on STEM-related fields.
Very good. Representative.
Good morning. For the record, Julie Parrish, House District 37. Always interesting to come testify in front of revenue. I kind of feel like I'm always asking mom and dad for money when I come here. appreciate the opportunity to talk about this bill. 20-some years ago, I used to belong to the Oregon Student Lobby. It's now the Oregon Student Association. And for 20 years, the association has asked this body for a reprieve on tuition increases. And in 20 years, I don't know that I've ever seen a reprieve in tuition increases. Tuition has continued to go up and up and up. And so now students in Oregon are graduating with some of the highest debt load that they have ever carried, on average as high, somewhere between $23,000 and $27,000. I know for some students in some fields it's even higher, as the cost of things like engineering and healthcare and high-need fields are just a very long slog, 8 years of school, and a lot of debt load. And so this bill is really designed at two things. One, helping certainly to reduce that burden for students in a different way than a tuition decrease. Clearly, we're not going to get to that after 20 years of watching kids and students come to this body and ask for that. That's not happening. So this is a reprieve a different way. And we're really looking and focusing in this bill with post-recession graduates. Graduates who graduated into this recession, who are in a very high unemployment class, who are part of a national epidemic of potential default risk on student loans. And so this bill is being brought forward on behalf of the Oregon Student Association, used a priority bill to get this done. And what the bill does is two things. One, it's got a piece in there that it's a subtraction for interest on student loan, similar to what the federal government does. And so, of course, subtraction being right off the top of the federal AGI number and then doing the rest of the tax return. And then there's a credit, and this is Representative Davis. I'm going to let him speak to this a little bit because this is we've decided to mash two concepts into one bill. But there's a credit in there for particularly for STEM STEM fields. We have a shortage, and Rep. Davis knows the numbers off the top of his head of what that job market looks like for STEM, but shortage of people in those fields, and really this is designed to keep Oregon students here in Oregon. There are certainly jobs in Texas and all other places, and we see our graduates going that direction, so part of this is about keeping that kind of brain drain, if you will, from leaving Oregon. We want to keep young students here. We want to keep them putting their roots into our state and contributing in these particularly high needs fields, some of the healthcare and engineering and science fields, and help build and grow our economy. And right now those kids are leaving at a pretty fast clip because there are better deals for them in other states. And so we're hopeful that this body will look at this. I believe that we, fiscals come back. I don't think the fiscal is astronomical or something that we can't overcome as a body to incentivize students to stay here, to help them from defaulting on their student loans, and to keep that talent here in Oregon. And I will, you know, just ask Rep. Davis to share about the credit piece, if you will. Sorry to put you on the spot.
No, absolutely. Chair?
Representative Davis?
Thank you, Chair. The statistic that Representative Parrish is referring to is one that I use often, which is that depending on which year you count, in the last 2 years, we have approximately 3 to 4 unemployed Oregonians for every one open job. In science, technology, and engineering fields, that statistic flips on its head, and we have between 1.5 and 2 open jobs for every qualified Oregonian. And particularly in the science, technology, engineering, and math fields, many of our graduates graduate from Oregon schools and find more lucrative offers in Seattle or San Jose or Texas and other firms who can pay more than we can in Oregon. And so the credit embodied in this legislation is an effort to both entice Oregon graduates of Oregon institutions in STEM-related degrees to stay in Oregon, and to encourage them to reinvest at least 15 hours per month in STEM-related volunteer service. So the local robotics club, the local science club, working with the high school, working with a career technical program at a high school, for example. And if they are willing to do that at the rate of 15 hours per month and stay and work in Oregon, they would have the benefit of a credit of 50% of the interest they pay on their loans. This is a declining credit. Every $10,000 above $70,000 of their income, the credit declines 5%. So if you have an income of $70,000, you get a 50% credit. $80,000, you get a 45% credit. $90,000, you get it declines 5% until $170,000, where the credit goes away altogether.
And I want to talk about the volunteer piece because I think that's really important on that credit. You know, my husband has an engineering degree from West Point, so fortunately he doesn't have student loans on that. And this year he coached 4 Lego robotics teams for the younger kiddos. It's incredible enough to coach 1 team, let alone coaching 4, and 2 of them ended up placing in the regionals. And the interesting thing is that, you know, my community was very well represented in those regionals. When I look at, you know, Sherwood and Westland and Wilsonville and Tualatin and that area, there are so many places in our state that are underserved by the technology that kids aren't participating in those programs. And it's as a mother and as somebody who wants to see all kids in Oregon thrive, for us to be able to reach into the community, the technology community, and get folks like we do for the Classroom Law Project and like we do for some of these other these other opportunities where people are donating their time and sharing and giving to kids. We need a nation of kids who are going to be globally competitive, and particularly in the STEM fields. So to ask people and leverage and incentivize people to get in and think about a long-term commitment of their time. And I know what it took, you know, at our house to coach 4 teams every day after school for 3 months. And you know, and an all-girls team, which, you know, we need young ladies to go into these fields as well. a huge commitment of time. To not only get qualified people who are qualified and professional in their field, but then to get them back giving into their community, I think is absolutely critical. And if this body can help move that dial, particularly in these fields, then I think we have an obligation to look at that. And, you know, I get that times are tight, but we do have, you know, in this biennium, we've had more general fund dollars than we've ever had. This is a small ask. And we have said, a lot of us have campaigned and said, we're going to make reinvestments into higher education. I am absolutely committed to that personally. And I believe that, you know, as a body, we've said that we want to do that. So I would hope that we dig deep and find ways to support students, find ways to support the STEM industry in our state, as we want to continue to grow that as a hub from an economic development perspective. I believe deeply that after 20 years of asking, students in Oregon need a reprieve, and it's time to do something for higher ed. So with that, I'll take any questions, or I'll get out of your hair because it's a busy morning, I think, for all of us.
Great. Thank you very much. Questions? Yes, Representative Bailey.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I will simply make a comment and put a question mark at the end. Pretend it's a question. But I appreciate the focus on STEM. I understand the reasons for the focus on STEM. I think when you add arts to the equation, you get STEAM, and that really powers our economy.
I will take your amendment, Rep. Bailey.
I would simply say that I believe that while investments in STEM are important for the reasons that were stated, and ensuring that we're making investments in arts educations to develop the creative minds of the next generation of leaders, to start businesses, and to work in the economy that I think is really going to be a 21st century economy is incredibly important as well. So I'd like to if this concept does move forward, think about additional ways we could invest. And if you have any, I will put a question mark at the end for any comment.
So since Chair Barnhart, Rep. Bailey, and since there is a quasi-question mark at the end of that, I will say, you know, the subtraction piece in the first part of the bill really is designed to get at all of those other fields as well, so that we are looking at people who have humanities degrees, and we are giving, you know, people who have artistic background, you know, healthcare fields across the board, that there is a component in that for all students, because I think we do need all of those professions, and we do need people to go into those fields and be creative minds and be thoughtful thinkers, and all what the rest of those that dearth of studies, what that brings to society in general. So I think that, at least in my mind, for now, that is represented in the subtraction. I think the credit piece being STEM-related, you know, certainly is a carve-out for those fields because it is a high need. But I think the subtraction part for everybody across the board who are in this window, and this bill does have a sunset on it, so understand that this is not a forever ask. We really want to target those post-recession graduates, but working with the Student Association, I think we believe that the subtraction helps give some relief to everybody in every field.
Very good. Yes, Representative Vega Peterson, please.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you, Representative Parrish, for bringing this forward. This is a really important issue. So I guess two things. One is just a comment. I think this was the first year that we actually were able to freeze tuition rates for colleges starting in 2014, so that is something that we're making positive steps on. The second thing is I come from a technology background. I absolutely know that we need to have more folks in STEM, and so I'm really glad you're bringing this bill forward. We, in my house, you can't walk through a room without stepping on a pink Lego Friends block.
Which is great.
So I know you probably know what that means. My six-year-old right now, she loves building Legos. So I think anything that we can do to encourage children to have interest in STEM and continue that interest, you know, through junior high, through high school, and into college, because we are, just like Rep. Davis said, we do have a dearth of qualified applicants right now for all the jobs that are out there. My husband has a company where they build websites, and they're looking for programmers, and there's so much competition in finding qualified applicants for those jobs. And so I just want to commend you for bringing this forward. But I did have a question.
Sure.
If we knew at this time, this is more for staff, of what the impact of this change would be. Do we have that information yet?
Representative Vega Peterson, I have started some preliminary work on that, and it's kind of an outline of the thought process, because there are two pieces to it and there are a lot of layers to it. So I do have some numbers that I can share.
Okay, yeah. And, you know, and the thing of it is, and thank you, Rebecca Peterson, I appreciate that. Two things. You know, one about girls and technology. If girls do not get into the technology fields early in their K-12 education, you lose them by about middle school. And so beyond the pink Legos, I only have boys, so we have no pink Legos at my house. But we have buckets of other Legos and lots of the robotics ones. There's a maker movement that's happening right now where, you know, young girls are being taught fashion, technology, and things that are of, you know, kind of more interest for girls, but they're sewing LED lights into the clothes and turning, you know, and making technology happen with fabrics and a whole, there's a whole push to get to these young girls and get them into these fields. And so, so I think that's a critical piece. There is, again, kind of some preliminary numbers on this that I don't know if they are available in OLIS yet or if we're that far yet, but I appreciate the how fast that you all have put those numbers back to me when I asked for those numbers this week. So, and again, I don't think it's in the grand scheme of our budget is an astronomical ask. And yes, we did freeze tuition this year, but only after an increase in the first part of the biennium for them. So, I mean, I still think we have a long way to go. You know, I've continued to pay my own student loans, and I get it, and I don't want that for kids. It is, you know, when you think about what's happening in other kind of sectors of finance right now where, you know, home mortgages have become harder to get, and you take somebody who's got an $800 a month student loan payment walking out of college and then ask them to save 20% for down payment on a house. I mean, we are precluding a nation of kids from ever getting out from under ginormous amounts of debt to home ownership, self-sufficiency, and freedom from, you know, these huge payments. And, you know, if there you've got a student who does have a bankruptcy, student loan debt is not dischargeable. So the minute that a kid gets underwater with their student loans, it impacts their credit scores, it impacts their ability to seek any kind of, you know, a car, a house, a job, potentially, for those industries who require a credit check as part of their job. So, you know, the notion that we can help through a bill like this for these post-recession graduates to help keep them solvent really, I think, is an important critical piece of this bill. So thank you.
Thank you. Other questions, comments for the representative? I have one, and it may be for several of you who are apparently involved in this area. How do wages in these fields compare to wages generally? Do we know? Representative Davis?
Yes, Chair. They're generally above the median, and in many instances, significantly. I assume you're referring to STEM fields when you say
correct.
Use the term fields.
Yes.
Yes.
Yeah, and this is true even for people who are new in the field?
That's right, yeah. Just for example, Oregon Tech in my district with the Wilsonville campus, which graduates about 91% of its students into jobs within 6 months. I'm going to quote it wrong, and I saw Lita around the back of the room, but I believe their median is somewhere around $50,000 for that's new graduates, which is
new
substantially
place.
Above the median.
First-year employee.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, and remember, too, that STEM is not necessarily a four-year degree. I think I need to clarify that. So not everyone comes out with huge debt. But there's also a population of kids who come out with, you know, a STEM or vocational type degree who, you know, are not using their, because they went to a community college, not necessarily using their student loans for tuition, but they're using it for housing. They're using it for food. Our community colleges are seeing more social service needs than they've ever seen right now at the community college level that they're, quite frankly, not equipped to deal with. And so a lot of that student loan debt is being incurred for the living expense of just trying to get through school. But if you look at a program like the AMP Mechanics School at PCC, which I believe is a three-year program, not a lot of debt incurred in the tuition, potentially a lot of debt incurred in just the living expenses, which was frankly where I incurred my debt. I didn't have a place to live, and I lived in the dorms, and I spent a lot of money just trying to, you know, subsist and live through college. So
So I understand where that spending is happening, and it's artificially driving up the cost of education for kids when they are struggling to have those social service and basic needs met, and they're using student loans to get that done. But the interesting thing about a program like that is we have jobs, you know, at the Aurora Airport, and you drive by the Aurora Airport, and it's this tiny little airstrip, and you don't think anything of it till you get there, and you actually see that there's more than $1 billion of economic activity happening at the airport, and they are importing workers, flying them in, because we don't have qualified people. So they are coming in from Maryland and from all over the country, and every 2 weeks they come here and they work, and then they go home and they take their money with them. So part of this is about getting people into those fields so that those dollars stay here in Oregon. And I appreciate how we do, you know, revenue statements and things, but we don't, in our process, put that type of impact into our revenue statements about what it means to then suddenly have those people working in Oregon's economy and not flying off to the East Coast every 2 weeks because we don't have the people here to do those jobs.
Yeah. Great.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Appreciate it.
Other questions for the representative? Thank you.
Thank you.
I have two witnesses, two others signed up. Amanda, is it Moose, perhaps? And Marcia Kelly. Would you come up, please? Is there anyone else who wants to be heard on this bill this morning? Yes, Ms. Weiser, please. Good morning.
Good morning. Chair Bernhardt, Vice Chair Bailey, and Vice Chair Berger, thank you for being here and hearing me out today. My name is Amanda Mose, and I am a student at Western Oregon University and a member of the Oregon Student Association Board of Directors. I'm seated in front of you today to talk about a huge burden in my life, my student loan debt. Currently, the average debt of an Oregon student among graduation is about $26,000, as you heard from Representative Parrish. And for every student with only $5,000 to $10,000 of that debt, there's a student like myself with upwards of $40,000. As a third-year student with hopes of attending graduate school in the near future, I feel anxious about continuing my education, the amount I will owe, and I'm apprehensive about the financial instability that I'll face post-graduation. My situation is unique but not uncommon. In 2010, when I was getting ready to apply for college, my parents filed for Chapter 13 bankruptcy, which means I was left to pay for college all on my own. When I applied for federal student aid, I learned that there was no way to indicate on that application my situation, making me only eligible for loans. A student loan tax benefit would make post-graduation plans for Oregon students like myself much less daunting and also promote the future of Oregon's economy by keeping our educated minds within our state. There are thousands of students like myself in frightening financial situations, and the return on this investment would benefit the economy because Oregonians would gain jobs in our state and, of course, pay taxes. While House Bill 4097 is not a solution to our debt problem, it's a refreshing start, and I urge you to fully support this bill and help students like myself maintain a livable standard in Oregon as we take on the debt that we have acquired by choosing post-secondary education. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you. And what area? What's your area of study?
It's psychology.
And would that come under this bill?
Yes, I believe that it is all
as a science.
Yeah.
All right. Thank you. Please.
Chair Barnhart and members of the committee, my name is Marcia Kelly, and I'm the public policy advocate for the American Association of University Women. And the idea of a tax credit for college is a good idea. However, the reason we're talking about that is we have continually disinvested in our higher education, which is what has created the high debt load for students. I think it's a nice idea, but I would like to see the physical impact before we would jump on in support of this bill. It's much better to do the investment at the front end with higher participation in the cost of education than it is to reward the few who get through. Thank you.
Thank you. Yes, ma'am.
For the record, I'm Jody Weiser, representing Tax Service Oregon. So I think my comments are very similar to Marcia's. We are investing $115 million this year in Oregon Opportunity Grants. It's enough, this biennium, it's enough to fund only 23% of the eligible applicants. In our neighboring state, they're complaining because they're only funding 78% of their eligible applicants. It's if we are providing grants at the front end, people don't end up with debt at the back end. And it seems that if our goal is reinvestment in education, then we should be at the front end where people are getting educated. If we find that there's room in the budget for whatever the Chris's forecast is on that impact, then it should go into the Oregon Opportunity Grant Program, and maybe then we'd be able to get these grants to another 5% or 10% of our population. Though that's where our basic responsibility is, both what is the tuition level, and then what grants do we have that are available based on need. And the tuition grants are based on need, whereas the interest deduction would not be based on real need. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Questions for this panel? Thank you very much. I simply want to note that I really appreciate the concern that many of us share about the high cost of education in our communities. I have to admit that this bill I do not see as particularly part of the solution to our issue, and I think the reason for my seeing it that way is a little different than the ones we just heard, and that's why I wanted to mention it. What this bill does is it gives a tax deduction or a tax credit to those who have income and would otherwise owe taxes. It doesn't help people who come out of college and move into a bleak economic world and have the difficulties that were mentioned earlier and being unable to pay their student loan debt and finding themselves in an endless cycle because it's not dischargeable in bankruptcy. That was already mentioned earlier. We need to figure out ways to reduce the cost of education to our students. I've said this before, I'm going to say it again. When I went to school, back in the dark ages, tuition was low. It was possible for an energetic person to work during the summer full-time and part-time during the school year, pay tuition, pay room and board, pay for books, not have a whole lot left over for other things, certainly not a car, but sufficient so it was possible to graduate from college without any debt at all and without borrowing any money or getting any scholarships, or at least any significant scholarships. That isn't possible anymore. Cannot be done. And the reason why it can't be done is because we have done a very poor job since about 1993 of actually supporting our colleges and universities in the way we need to. The time to pay for college is when you're in your middle years and you have good income and you pay taxes. That's the time to pay for it, not when you have no income, you're young and new, and we don't support the college system. We've gotten it backwards in Oregon. We need to go back to the system we had before that actually worked very well. My generation probably is the best educated generation in American history. The generation coming up now is not. And probably the primary reason for that is because of the disincentives involved in our system. We're going to continue, at least as long as I'm in this chair, looking at issues that will help support our students. I have to tell you that my own inclination is to support the idea of better scholarships for those in need and better general support for universities and colleges rather than a system like this, which will benefit those who actually have income sufficient to help to pay for their loans. I invite other comments, but otherwise I plan to close the hearing. Thank you. We'll close the public hearing on House Bill 4097, and we'll open a public hearing on House Bill 4129. Who's on that one? Oh, yes, please. And then Representative Clem, you're on deck. Yes, go ahead.
Morning, Chair.
Are there other members who want to be heard this morning, other representatives or senators on this bill? Well, I have a big list, and I'm going to go right on through it after that. I hope you're signed up. Okay. Page two. Great. Representative, I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Morning, Chair, members of the committee. This is House Bill 4129 that proposes to increase tax rates on cigarettes and tobacco products, create a definition for vapor products to include electronic cigarettes and nicotine solution in the definition of tobacco products for purpose of tax, to direct revenue from the increased tax revenue to be distributed by the Oregon Health Authority to provide for preventive services, non-traditional health assistance, and mental health services.
Yeah, Representative Bailey.
Mr. Chair, I'd simply note that Vijay here might need to know that Mazen usually makes a poor joke about tobacco when he hears these bills. So if you could just insert that.
So he needs to work on his sense of humor.
That's right.
I need to catch up with Mazen.
We need more poor jokes around.
And okay. You certainly may consult.
It's big shoes.
You certainly may consult with him on that topic. I would encourage you to ignore Representative Bailey's comment.
Everybody else does.
I'm keeping up with Mazen, so I'll catch up on this.
Okay, on this as well. Very good. Representative Clem, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Brian Clem, State Representative from District 21, which is here in Salem. We're in the we're kind of in the middle of my district right now. It's kind of the middle of Salem generally. I wanted to come here and talk to you about one of my two bills for the session. We all got two. This is one of my two, House Bill 4129. And what this does is, hello, Senator.
Hello.
What this does is raise the cigarette tax by $1.50 a pack. And this would not even get us to Washington's levels, but it would get us pretty close. Obviously, this isn't the Health Policy Committee, which I serve on and with Representative Conger. So I won't probably go into all the policy details I normally would, because you're the Revenue Committee, and you probably want to know about the mechanics and all that kind of stuff. But just since we didn't have a policy hearing, since this is the short session, and I think they just decided, let's get it straight down here. I can tell you that tobacco and smoking is the leading cause of preventable death in the United States. And so if you can get yourselves out of the revenue mode for just a moment, think about that. This is the leading cause of people dying in our country. And I've got other studies that demonstrate the price of cigarettes is probably the most effective way to lead people to stop smoking. So take those two facts together, that through taxation, or if you can talk the cigarette companies into raising prices, I guess on their own voluntarily, very high, you could save many, many, many lives in this state. Now, this bill was something that I worked with the CCOs to develop, and the funds, generally speaking, go to them. There's a mental health holdback of 15% for mental health-related treatments. Certainly, one of the problems we've had with the tax in the past is it being used for things other than tobacco prevention. The goal of some of these dedications, even though they're statutory, is to not have these funds be used for, you know, other things. I would say there's an argument that the tobacco related illnesses certainly cost the general fund money broadly. So even if you just raise the tax and let it go to the general fund, that's probably still a good idea, because cigarette smoking causes a drain on the general fund, certainly. But in this case, we're dedicating it actually to the health care instrument that this state has decided is our way to help make people healthier in the Oregon Health Plan population. At some point, CCOs may take on a broader role, but right now they're targeting a certain population for the delivery of health care in a coordinated fashion. That population tends to be a higher user of tobacco products, unfortunately. And so in this case, the funds would go to help the people who are probably most in need of getting treatment so they can quit. If nicotine weren't in there, I wouldn't even be here. If three of my four grandparents weren't I'd like to use the term murdered, but if they didn't die from tobacco smoking, one, my grandmother never even smoked in her life, and she still died from lung cancer. So if we could take the nicotine out and it was just a free choice versus people making a product designed to eventually hook and kill your own customers, I wouldn't be here. But we're not. That's the nature of cigarettes. And so I'm here in front of the Revenue Committee asking you to see if you can do something about the leading cause of death in this country.
Very good. Well, after the call from members, I got two more. Please.
Thank you so much, Chair Barnhart, members of the committee. For the record, Elizabeth Steiner Hayward, State Senator for District 17, Northwest Portland, Beaverton area, and also a family physician, former president of the Oregon Academy of Family Physicians, and very honored to sit here with Representative Ken Clem, Representative Kenny Geyer, and others in support of this bill. I want to be crystal clear. I hope that eventually we have almost no revenue from this bill, which is one of the reasons why it's a little weird to have it sit in front of a revenue committee, but it's a tax, so it has to. Ultimately, I hope we don't have to depend on this money at all, and we shouldn't depend on it because it should, as Representative Clem said, decrease the number of people who smoke and certainly decrease the number of people who start smoking. Adolescents are particularly sensitive to the price point on cigarettes, and they're much less likely to start smoking if it's that much more expensive. And we know that if people don't start smoking until they're in their early or late mid-20s, they're much less likely to start at all. And if they do start, they're much less likely to become addicted. Let me be crystal clear. Nicotine is more addictive than cocaine. It's about equally addictive to heroin. Heroin and cocaine are illegal drugs, and yet nicotine-containing products are not. Nicotine is more addictive than alcohol. It's more addictive than marijuana. It's more addictive than a lot of other things that we consider illegal or dangerous. And yet it's more dangerous, as Representative Clem quite rightly pointed out, than any of those other things that I mentioned. It really is. It's very possible to use alcohol safely in limited quantities. Lots and lots. The vast majority of people who use alcohol do. The vast majority of people who use tobacco products do not use them in a way that they can really control without a significant amount of effort. Cigarette taxes should be viewed primarily as a public health intervention and not a revenue-generating source. So I'm sorry to sit in front of the Revenue Committee and say that, but ultimately I hope that we'll see, as we've started to see in many other states that have raised their taxes, that revenue from cigarettes goes down, as it should. But dedicating some of this money to mental health is really important because right now we've seen substantial decreases in smoking incidents among generally healthy people. The place we have not seen a decrease, and in fact have seen an increase, is in people with severe persistent mental illness. And in general, people with chronic mental illness tend to smoke more than people without chronic mental illness or with mental illness that's well controlled. So if we dedicate money toward treating people with mental illness, toward tobacco prevention, then we will actually be putting this money to good use in the population most severely affected by this drug. I urge your support for this. I know that it's tough to pass taxes. I get that. I get how powerful the tobacco industry is. We're here to serve Oregonians. We're here to help Oregon be the healthiest state in the nation. And this is an amazing way that we can do this. So I urge your support for this bill. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Representative.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and colleagues. I'm really honored to join my colleagues on the House and Health Senate Healthcare Committees. As a lifelong advocate for public health with a master's in public health. Oh, I'm sorry. I'm Alyssa Kenny Geyer, House District 46, parts of Southeast Northeast Portland. So this has been a lifelong passion of mine, and I just want to reiterate everything they've said about the need to pass a tax, not only to raise revenue. There will be, unfortunately, some people that still smoke, and we need the revenue to help with treatment and to continue providing cessation programs as well as prevention programs. But really, it is a huge factor in helping people quit. Studies over and over have shown that the more that you raise the tax, more people quit. Low-income people and young people in particular are very price-sensitive, and it's much better to try to prevent people from starting in the first place than to put enormous energy into trying to get people to quit as adults. So it's very important. I missed the beginning of yours because I was running down here, so I'm at risk of repeating maybe something that you said. 43.8 million Americans smoke, and studies have shown that 80% of those want to quit. They need the help to be able to do so. 42,000 people under the age of 18 are smoking. Over 4,000 Oregon youth every year start smoking. Tobacco costs Oregonians $1.2 million in health care costs alone, as well as the estimate is $2 billion if you include lost productivity. And just to highlight some of the challenges and show how people all around the state really care about this, Mel Cheney, who's executive director of the Community Cancer Foundation and the Community Cancer Center in Roseburg, has said tobacco use is perhaps the single most significant preventable health problem in the world. The costs to our communities are staggering. Hundreds of thousands of lives lost, money spent to treat smoking-related diseases, lost worker productivity, and damage from cigarette-induced fires every year in Oregon. Taxing an addictive and harmful product to discourage its use is a worthwhile idea. With every increase in tobacco taxes, usage has declined. Tax revenue can be directed toward health care for lung disease and cancer, as well as asthma and a variety of other things. So that brings us to the House Bill 4129, which I vigorously support. This it discourages initiation among youth, as has been said, increases cessation among current smokers, and reduces average cigarette consumption among those who continue to smoke. As tobacco prices go up, people smoke less. Smokers quit, and youth do not start. It's estimated that a 10% increase in price reduces cigarette consumption among adults by about 4% and has an even greater impact among youth and low-income smokers. Oregon's tax is currently at $1.31. 21 states have cigarette taxes that are at $2 or more per pack. Six of those are at $3 or more per pack, including Washington State. Since New York State raised its rate to $4.35 a pack and New York City raised its rate to $5.85 a pack, smoking has dropped significantly. One of the biggest questions has always been, how will this affect low-income people? This is a fair question, because low-income people smoke at roughly twice the rate as the general population, 31.4% as opposed to 17.7%. High-income earners are around 11%. The high cost of smoking to low-income populations, from the cost of buying cigarettes to the cost of poor health care, poor outcomes, is a barrier to their climbing out of poverty. Because low-income groups are more responsive to price increases, increasing the price of cigarettes can reduce cigarette consumption among low-income smokers by a greater percentage than among high-income smokers, thereby diminishing socioeconomic smoking disparities. I'm on the board of Northwest Health Foundation. We produced a study that showed the impact on low-income and how people think it's going to actually increase cost to them, but actually, overall, it decreases because of the cessation and better health care costs. Secondly, in addition to raising the price to incentivize cessation, we need to provide free cessation programs to those who can't afford them. We can't just say, sorry, price is high, you're on your own. This is why 4129 makes sense. CCOs across the state can be empowered to provide services to the Medicaid population to break this cycle. I want to also support any kind of designation to mental health, because people who have mental health tend to smoke at twice the rate of people that do not struggle with mental health and addictions. So it's very important to provide that kind of support. I would also support an amendment that would designate 10% or 15 cents a pack to the state's tobacco prevention program, which is an important partner in the CCOs to sharing best practices across the state. Currently, 4 cents of each pack goes to the state tobacco prevention funding, which is spent on cessation programs through the counties, surveillance, statewide media, statewide quit line. This is a really important piece of what we do. Even though we are very underfunded at 4 cents a pack, is about 25% of CDC recommendations, it's really critical. And in fact, this tax could end up, because of reducing consumption, reducing the amount that goes to the state. So I think it's really important that we take that into effect. We do not want to undermine our state prevention. And so I fully support 15 cents a pack to increase this program, which would actually fully fund it at the CDC levels. So, colleagues, we have an opportunity to significantly reduce the prevalence of the number one preventable cause of chronic disease and death in Oregon, save millions of dollars in health care costs, not to mention productivity, every year, and lead the country in smoking cessation. I urge your support.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, Senator, if I may add one more point, please. That when Representative Kenny Guyer mentioned productivity, it did occur to me to point out one thing very clearly to this committee. We may ultimately not get very much revenue from this if it works the way it's supposed to. We will get substantially increased revenue in other ways, because we will not have parents missing work because their kids have asthma exacerbations, because we will not have workers at lower productivity levels because they're struggling with chronic health conditions induced by tobacco use, because we will not be seeing people missing time time from work overall, either because of their or their children's illnesses, because children will get more, we will be more likely to hit our 40-40-20 goals, because we know that absenteeism is a leading cause of failure to graduate high school on time. And we will see a decrease ultimately in our corrections costs, because the costs that we incur from inmates who smoke and also from people who end up in the criminal justice system who never should have if they'd gotten a proper education, which can be enhanced by actually having kids in school, we will be helping by decreasing smoking. So those are some other points to consider. We may not get ultimately direct revenue from this. We will get indirect revenue that I think will be very important and of a kind that we can all be much happier to get, because it means Oregonians will be working. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Questions for this panel? I simply want to note that I very much appreciate all your testimony. I should note that this committee technically isn't supposed to be a healthcare committee, but the fact is this is one topic that we know pretty well because we seem to be dealing with it at least once every session, sometimes a couple of times. But I would also add that all three of you have added things in your testimony that I did not know, and I appreciate that. Representative Clem, did you have something to add?
I was just going to comment, Mr. Chair, if you would get this tax into law, we'll stop coming back every session.
Oh, I hope not. I've gotten sort of used to having these conversations. And
what about neonicotinoids down the hall?
Down the hall.
Want to talk about some other chemicals.
Right. Dealing with our small buzzy friend.
That's right.
Yeah. Yes.
And we're happy to continue to educate the committee, Mr. Chair, if there are other topics this committee would like to hear about that relate to revenue and health combined.
Oh, I'm in big trouble now, I can tell.
I'll tell two space stories. Yeah. If you want. They're pretty
Well, we do sensitive. Have a very long list today, and I'd like to try to get through it this morning. I appreciate very much the three of you coming and Representative Clem for bringing this bill.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair.
I have at least 13 people signed up. I don't know if anyone else who wants to be heard. We have 39 minutes, if I count correctly, before the end of our hearing today. I would love to get through this list, so I'm going to ask people to restrict their testimony to things that we haven't already heard and to present their information in the shortest form possible. I'm going to set a three-minute clock and ask you to adhere to that. And I'm just going to go down the list from the top. I probably will have difficulty pronouncing some names, so please bear with me. It looks like Tommy Devereaux, Earl, one person. Sorry, yes, thank you. Please come forward. Paul Bates, David Glenn, those three. You're finding yourself here a lot these days, aren't you?
Yeah, I'm trying not to, but yep. You keep making me come back.
Yep. Please go ahead and.
Yes.
And
I'm Tommy Devereaux. I'm here in opposition of this tax bill, and I'm not. The piece that I'm in opposition of is including e-cigarette products as a tobacco product. They are not tobacco products. They are a nicotine product. Nicotine does not kill. Nicotine is a class 2 stimulant that is not different than caffeine. Last week while we were testifying in the health services bills, there in Seattle was a international convention on tobacco and tobacco research. And from that, they brought forth several studies. I know I kind of bombarded you guys with a lot of studies to look at. Former Surgeon General Richard Camona is now on the board of Enjoy, which is a national cigarette company. And the reason he's on that board is because he believes in the public health ability of these drugs. I believe it's medically unethical to tax a product that is doing essentially what the Surgeon General has not been able to do in its last 50 years of tobacco cessation. We have quit smoking. And it's been a grassroots movement. We, the people, developed this technology, and we keep developing it. We're not happy that Big Tobacco in the last 2 years has tried to steal the ideas that we have and leech off of it, and they're not doing it in an effective way. I would like to... in the research that was discussed in Seattle last week, there was a new study. I'm pulling up. I submitted all of this. This is.
And we do have your written testimony. We have three different documents from you.
Yes.
And I will certainly ask the committee to read all of them. You presented some very interesting arguments that I think the committee should be aware of.
Why I think it's medically unethical to tax e-cigarettes. Konstantinos Sparsalinos is a leading cardiologist researcher from the Onassis Center in Greece. He's been presenting many studies on the safety of e-cigarettes. There's a study that I've listed in those groups showing the impact of vaping e-cigs as compared to two cigarettes on cardiovascular tissue in the aorta. There is zero effect and zero constriction of cardiovascular tissue from vaping an e-cigarette, as opposed to up to 30% in two cigarettes. I was a 20-year pack-a-day smoker.
Right. And could you wrap it up, please? That would be very helpful.
Okay. There's a lot of research. Please look at what the think tanks have produced even last week in Seattle. I presented that information. They feel that and they also stated that it was, their conclusion was that it was medically unethical as a public health implication to tax e-cigarettes. Tennessee and Wisconsin are specifically putting in their Clean Air Act and in their tobacco policy and taxation, they're specifically excluding vapor products. And I ask that you do the same. And I'm here to be a partner and help, and I'm very passionate about this, but I'm...
Thank you.
It's changed my life and my children's life. We all know how... I'm an ER nurse for 14 years. I have held people and their family members after I've watched them gasp to breathe, and they die probably in the hundreds. And I ask that you give me and my friends and the world the chance to breathe and to deal with the nicotine addiction and tobacco harm reduction, the same as heroin and methadone.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Please, gentlemen.
Oh, hi, my name is Paul Bates. Drove up from Portland this morning. Sorry, I'm a little bit, didn't know this was happening quite this now. I've come to only oppose one section of 4129, and that's the conflation of e-cigarettes with vaping with the tobacco portion. I'd just like to say it's too early for the regulation of electronic cigarettes. The industry has come so far from its infancy, and it's still evolving rapidly right now. We still don't know where it's going. Innovation is coming at an extremely fast pace and may make any current regulation outdated almost before it is signed. Regulation now would be detrimental in the extreme and quite likely counterproductive even to the wishes and goals of the well-meaning policymakers behind this bill. One of the worst things to happen to e-cigarettes was calling them cigarettes, e-cigarettes. While the first devices produced were meant to mimic cigarettes, the industry is quickly outgrowing what we call cig-alikes. In general, the vaping public disdains them. We hate cigarettes. Just like to make that quite clear, everybody here. We hate cigarettes. What we're going for is a true paradigm shift. Look how adamantly we refer to vaping as vaping rather than smoking. None of us say we're smoking because we're not. Trying to fit vaping into any existing legislation on the tails of tobacco regulations is like trying to saddle a zebra because it has four legs and a tail. Would you try to tax a new clean electric car exactly like a gasoline one?
Yeah.
Would public policy be focused on whether it had four wheels and got you from place to place or on its public impact? I think we would all vote for the latter option. Vaping should not be equated with cigarettes and tobacco products. We will support taxes and regulations for the vaping community, but not before the industry is out of its infancy. Look at how the Internet has been allowed to grow. It brought a revolution to our way of life. It is arguably the single greatest thing to come out of the social and business health and well-being in the last 50 years, and the U.S. is stronger for it. Let the U.S. lead the way in vaping or e-cigarettes as well. Let's let the free market take over, guide it as it grows, rather than stifling it before it has a chance to save so many people. I did a quick calculation. There's something like 500,000 deaths a year caused by e-cigarettes. That would be approximately 4,000 people in Oregon alone. That's approximately 12 people per day. I think e-cigarettes may help reduce those deaths by up to like 90% in 10 to 15 years, but only if we let it stay an inexpensive option for those looking to switch from current use of tobacco to vaping. Look at the microbrewery revolution, one that began in large part due to the relaxation of regulations.
If you could wrap up, that would be very helpful.
Make beer.
Thank you.
Give me a couple of minutes, please.
Well, except we don't have a couple of minutes.
Okay. That started here in Oregon. Vaping is very much in the same category. No one would say that alcohol is a completely safe product. By any conceivable measure, beer is much more deadly than nicotine liquid ever could be. I'm not going to mention tobacco. You know, and there's nothing that beer replaces as a harmful. It's not like beer replaces heroin or something like that. Nicotine liquid replaces one of the most preventable, deadly health issues on the planet.
Thank you very much.
Can I have 30 more seconds,
please?
Well,
I've already given you an extra minute, so let's wrap it up very quickly.
Okay.
I'd like to get on, because other people would like to be heard today, and we'll have to cut them off if I allow people to
run. I will go as
on.
Fast as I possibly can with one final thing. I've been vaping for almost 2 years. I've had a business dedicated to vaping products since late September of last year, a mere 5 months. In those four or five months alone, I've seen rapid progress in the quality of equipment that is being produced. I have noticed another thing that is really remarkable. When I started carrying nicotine strengths up to 24 milligrams, generally considered a 1 to 2 pack-a-day smokers, and no zero nicotine when I first started. The call for lower and lower nicotine strengths has truly shocked me. Most customers are constantly trying to go lower and lower on their nicotine, and they're able to do it in a way they could never do with cigarettes. Sales of zero-milligram non-nicotine juices are the fastest climbing in my store, currently considering dropping the 24-milligram nicotine strength altogether. Of the five brands I carry, only two of them I carry up to 24 milligrams, necessary only for those heavy smokers to make the transition. Most of them drop a level or two within weeks or months. Now, the thing that we notice working in the trenches is the issue of dual use almost never comes up. Most people start vaping successfully, stop smoking, even if they never intended to when they first come in. Cigarettes become so foul and offensive that they simply can't smoke. Number of people who come back after 3, 5, 10 days, 2 months, tell me I haven't had a cigarette since I came in is simply amazing, one of the most gratifying experiences of my entire life.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much. And
thank you for the extra time, Chairman.
Well, you're welcome. David Glenn, please.
Hi, I'm David Glenn. I smoked for 20 years.
And if you want to say me too, that would be acceptable, unless that's something you would like to add.
It is. I'm more worried. I started a business based on the fact that I got into vaping,
it got me off of cigarettes. I went from, I was a 24 milligram smoker for a long time, or a vapor. I got off of cigarettes, I'm down to 6 milligrams, and it works for me. I'm weaning myself off of the nicotine using vapor, and I wanted to share that with other people, and I've started a business that is dedicated to helping people do that. We don't sell tobacco products. We sell vaping products. And the way that the current bill is structured, where it the vocabulary adds vaping into the other tobacco category, and it taxes the devices on such a level. We have fixed costs on the electronics, and I think there's a lack of understanding on what it entails. It's not just some little cigarette-looking device. It has a fixed cost to it, whereas that tax applied to those fixed costs on the products themselves would destroy the vaping industry. Chairman Bernhard, you testified there's 87 businesses in Oregon when you were talking about the 4115 bill. 87 businesses that are dedicated to trying to get people off of cigarettes and away from that addiction. And it's working. And you amended the 4115 bill to allow for the vape shops to exist because we believe in what it does to help people get off of tobacco. This tax bill would effectively kill it. It would completely kill the Oregon businesses' ability to sustain themselves because we can't compete with the online sales. Until FDA regulation comes out, which we hope it does. We want it. We want you guys to give it a chance for that to happen. Because online sales is where the Oregonians are going to go, or they're going to go across the border over into Washington, and they're going to buy what they need. And all the revenue that can be generated here in Washington State from the vape shops, I'm sorry, Oregon State, my apologies, all of that revenue that is generated is going to go out of state. It's going to go online. A $45 product that is a battery-operated object that is designed to help utilize the nicotine solution that's designed to give vapor. That is a fixed cost. And with the taxes that go on it, they would have to be passed on to the customer, which would be put well over $100. Customers aren't going to buy it there. They're going to go online and get it. We already compete with online stores, and the benefit we offer is training and advice and helping them get off of this stuff. If this bill passes with electronic cigarettes in there, you've killed the vaping industry. And right now, it's saving lives. I lost my mom to lung cancer 2 years ago. That's when my brother pushed me onto vapor. I didn't think anything was going to get me off of cigarettes. Vapor did. I haven't had a cigarette in well over a year and a half. This kills it if this bill goes through.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Are there questions for this panel?
I forgot to say, we represent 466 Oregon people just in our Portland Facebook group alone, 5,000 on my page, and over 600 Twitter followers. It's a social revolution in Oregon, and we believe in it. And
there are thousands of vapors escaping cigarettes.
Thank you. Thank you very much, and we'll go on to our next panel now. I do appreciate your testimony. Timothy, it looks like Schultz, Paul Romain, and Chris Gerard. Good morning. Please go ahead.
Good morning, Chairman. I'd like to go ahead and save a little bit of time and go ahead and say me too.
That'd be great.
But there's a couple of technical aspects about the bill.
Would you state your name for the record, please?
Timothy Schultz.
Thank you.
Couple of technical aspects that I want to go over briefly. One is the way these products are defined.
We're looking at page 7, I think.
Yeah, that's on page 7. Right here.
Page 6.
It says an electronic device
yes.
to heat nicotine solutions and other solutions for the purpose of producing vapor to be inhaled by the user of the device. Some of these devices may or may not even be electronic. That description kind of describes what's been spoke of as a Sigalikes. Then there's a device like this. This has electronics in it. But these devices are sold in different pieces. The only part that has electronics in this piece, which is sold differently from the tank. So the question then becomes, what gets taxed? Does it all get taxed? Does just the battery gets taxed? Then there are enthusiast devices like this, Your Honor, that again are sold in pieces. The battery, which is the only electronic component, is sold as a totally separate piece. It's used for flashlights and lots of other products. The rest of this comes with no wiring. It's called a mechanical device. It makes a physical connection on the battery with no wire except for the heating element. The heating element doesn't even come installed on the device and is something that's built by the enthusiast to put on it. Is that then called an electronic device or is it not? Does it get taxed or does it not? There's a lot of ambiguity in the bill as far as the products that I sell in my shop, where a lot of questions come up. I think in the short session, there with the field moving so quickly, it would be really hard to get an accurate definition of vaping products.
Thank you. And did you have a different point then in addition? You said a couple of technical issues.
Well, no, that is my technical. I don't have a definition to submit at this point.
Thank you. I don't mean to
I am
very aware, and I think the committee is, that definitions are an issue in this area. Gentlemen, please.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Paul Romaine. I'm with the Romaine Group with my daughter, Danelle, and we're here representing VMR Products, which is a company that produces and distributes and designs a whole catalog of electronic cigarette products. It's unfortunate that they're called electronic cigarettes because, as stated before, there's no tobacco in these things, and I think that's part of the problem here. We tend to try and treat them like tobacco when they're not. We have a varying line of products that have declining nicotine content. They're ways to get people off of traditional cigarettes. This is something, it's a new area that the legislature is stepping into way prematurely. What you need to do, we support bans on kids getting access to this stuff. Believe me, we don't want the kids to get it. But it's a way that you can transition existing smokers to something that does not harm anybody else out there. It's a product that needs to be encouraged at this point, not regulated to death. And frankly, this tax that you have in this bill will regulate it to death. It's something that you may take up next session when you have a little more time to talk about this, to think about it, but it's not something you should do right now. We also represent, my daughter and I, the Oregon Petroleum Association. We have a number of convenience stores that will transition into Mr. Gerard's testimony, although he disowns me half the time, so it's okay. Thank you. I'm finished. I respect the time, and I yield the rest of my time to anybody else.
Thank you. Mr. Gerard, please.
Good morning, Chair Barnhart, Vice Chairs Bailey and Berger, committee members. I'm Chris Gerard, CEO of Plant Pantry, and the chairman of ONSA, the Oregon Neighborhood Store Association. Plant owns and operates 108 convenience stores in the Northwest, with the majority of the stores being here in Oregon. We've been locally owned and operated for over 50 years. We employ 700 Oregonians. We provide our employees a full benefit package, including affordable health insurance. ONSA provides legislative and regulatory representation for Oregon's 2,900 smaller, mostly family-owned and operated convenience stores. Mr. Chair, if I had to pick one word to describe this bill, the word would be devastating. This huge tax increase is devastating for small businesses. It's devastating for all retail workers' jobs, pay, and benefits. It's devastating for a minority of consumers. And in the end, it's devastating to a critical revenue stream for the state.
How does this compare to
cigarette taxes, other tobacco products, and master settlement agreement payments total $334 million annually. To put this in perspective, this is 50% more than the total annual liquor revenue distributions from OLCC. But tobacco is a declining and fragile revenue stream that calls for delicate management. This bill is a legislative and fiscal step. 20 years ago, Oregon collected taxes on nearly twice the number of cigarettes as today. But aside from this underlying ongoing decrease in units available for taxing, more than doubling the current tax will severely damage this revenue source and will not produce near the incremental revenue you might expect. The relatively small incremental revenue it may produce would be more than offset by economic damage that would largely need to be replaced by additional state funding, new unemployment payments, additional supplemental nutrition assistance, and health benefits that were formerly paid by employers. Also, more than doubling taxes on a small group of citizens to benefit the overall population is not fair. And higher tobacco taxes do not significantly reduce consumption, but they drive consumers to avoid and evade taxes. there are two major components that should be considered. We're currently collecting over $62 million annually from Washington tobacco users. Most of this would go away literally overnight with this tax increase. 40 million packs would disappear. In addition, we will lose another 28 million packs because the influx of additional non-tax product to fill the demand created by such a large price gap. So not only will we not collect $1.50 on these 68 million lost units, but we'll lose the current $1.31 per pack. This proposed tax might raise a relatively modest $50 million, but this would be more than offset by $100 million in real payments to employees, hours worked, fewer jobs, less employer-paid benefits, including health insurance, and less revenue paid to Oregon small businesses. The math is in my written testimony.
Yep, and we appreciate the detail that you've gone into there.
In summary, this proposed tax is unfair. It hurts legitimate small businesses. It rewards and encourages illegal enterprises and unlawful activity. We're at the point where increasing the tax rate does not net new revenue to the state, considering these other liabilities created. And we're proposing to create new programs that funding demands are not going to be met by taxing tobacco alone. If taxes are increased, I think all citizens should be asked to sacrifice proportionally. We oppose this bill.
Thank you. Thank you very
Thank
much.
You.
Questions for this panel? Representative Benz, please.
Just one. Thank you. Can any one of you share with me the speed at which the transition is occurring from cigarettes to e-cigarettes?
Again, we're relatively new. This is Paul Romaine speaking for the record. We're relatively new to this this representation, but one of the statistics that we were given is one industry analyst recently predicted that e-cigarettes will surpass conventional tobacco cigarettes by 2017.
Follow up, Mr.
Yes, please.
And the question then, of course, is if we were going to assume that taxing e-cigarettes would replace taxing real cigarettes, how far off would we be by virtue of the quantity of e-cigarettes consumed?
Well, Mr. Chair, Representative Benz, if you start taxing e-cigarettes, you're going to push that date back much further. What happens now is you have access to something that people can get to, and it's a lot cheaper. If you start taxing e-cigarettes, you're going to push that, you're going to raise the price, and you're going to push people away from it. Right. That's not what you want to do.
Mr. Chair,
please.
Yeah. My question was, what if we did switch over, and assuming consumption transition continued to occur, we get a tax on every pack of cigarettes. I'm guessing, that's why I'm asking, is do you have to go buy an e-cigarette the same amount of times you got to buy a pack? My guess is you don't, but that's why I'm asking.
Mr. Chair, I'm absolutely incapable of answering that question because I'm not a smoker.
Yep, please.
We
have people here who are going to answer the question.
The most popular disposable unit that we sell, one is approximately equivalent to two packs of cigarettes.
Thank you.
Yes. And
Brad Porto, defense. Actually, in my experience, since as a user of the products, they're not really equivalent to two packs of cigarettes. But they're not. You don't buy a new device each time in most of the ones that people are successful in transitioning for. You buy fluids, you buy coils, and putting a they're used at a different rate. To actually say it's going to replace revenue at the same rate or not, it's hard to estimate without any accurate predictions at this point. It's too early to tell.
Thank you.
Thank
You're
you.
Welcome.
That's very helpful. Other questions? Thank you, gentlemen. We appreciate your testimony very much. Brian Berry, Jason Williams, please. And then I have two more panels after that of two people, so if you can be very brief, that would be helpful. Yes, please.
I can be brief. Good morning, Chairman Barnhart, Vice Chair Bailey, Vice Chair Berger, committee members. My name is Brian Berry. I'm the president of Core-Mark, Portland Division. Core-Mark is a national broad-based distributor of services and supplies to the convenient retail industry. We employ 300 Oregonians, and last year we paid $87 million, or 34% of the tax collected on tobacco, cigars, and cigarettes. I am a responsible licensed distributor. I opposed House Bill 4129, which increases the cigarette tax by 215%. and the tobacco tax by over 25%. I have 2 points to make. I'll make them briefly. Rather than repeat what was said earlier, the difference right now between Oregon and Washington is $17. The flow of income is coming this way. It's worth about $62 million. That will go away if this bill passes because the rate will be so minute that there will be no incentive to do that. The other point I want to make is that on this particular point is that chewing tobacco, the part that drives the tobacco business, which is Copenhagen Skoal, Kodiak, et cetera, our rate per unit, if this bill passes, would go from $1.78 per unit to $2.68, which would place us higher than the state of Washington, which is currently at $2.53, Idaho at $1.12, Nevada at 84 cents, and California at 83 cents. You cannot stamp this product. You cannot keep track of it. We will not sell any. It will be inbound from other states. Higher tobacco taxes don't stop use. They just move it to other areas to purchase. And what's going to happen once we have a rate of $28.10 if this bill passes is that we will begin to see a lot more of what is called casual and commercial smuggling. The higher the tax rate, the larger the smuggling rate. Casual smuggling is what we see in Vancouver when they come over to Oregon and buy personal product for personal use without the intent to resell. That's looked upon as almost socially acceptable because there doesn't seem to be any profiteering on it. Commercial is a different matter altogether. That's when the excise tax becomes so substantial between neighboring states that it becomes more prevalent and the economic benefit exceeds the associated risk. Then you begin to involve organized crime, and it's real, and it does happen. Yes, tobacco taxes in states did drive down New York, but it didn't drive down smuggling. State of New York has a 61% smuggling rate. The state of Washington, by their own accord, has a 48.5% smuggling rate. Wisconsin has a 36.4%. smuggling rate. Oregon right now has a 15% smuggling rate. That will go up probably in between Washington and Wisconsin and be about 40%. I don't think that's unreasonable to guess that. With the difference between Idaho being a tax rate of $5.70 and Oregon's proposed $28.10, that leaves a gap of $22.40. If an enterprising criminal, and there are such people, decided to rent a small truck or a van, a commercial van.
Yeah.
They could fit 200 cases in that. They could bring it across the border. That would carry 6,000 cartons. If they sold that at half the tax rate, they would make $67,200. If an organized criminals organization got involved, now you're looking at 53-foot tractor trailers walking up and down. You know the ones that you see up and down I-5 all day long? To rent one of those for a week is $700. To fill it full of diesel is $200, especially if it's a one-way trip. You can fit 1,900 cases of cigarettes. That's 57,000 cases in a 53-foot trailer. Now the profit goes to $638,000. Sound unreasonable? Not at all. It's happening all over the place in the Midwest and in the northeastern states. And I'll close by saying I strongly oppose House Bill 4129. The bill's sizable increase in cigarettes and tobacco taxation will adversely affect revenue streams in the long term while creating boundless potentials for encouraging criminal profiteering. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Yes, sir.
Chair, members of the committee, my name is Jason Williams, State Director of the Taxpayer Association of Oregon. I will try to keep this to 60 seconds. I've submitted some testimony. There's some great media articles this year. Ben Bulletin talks about Oregon being a lower cigarette use state and also about the misuse of funds, how even as small as 3% of the funds actually goes to the cessation programs. I think that that's just horrible. I think that we could do a lot to help by using more of the funds for what they need to be used for. And also the Statesman Journal article talking about how, you know, increasing it sometimes does not affect the actual smoking levels. So there's some local articles taking a local picture at it. With the teen smoking being as low as 10 to 11%, I just think it's bad that we punish 100% of the adults for the actions of 10% of the teens. There's got to be a better way. And my testimony at the bottom just shows you a lot of different things about how when we raise the taxes, the revenue disappears, so we're not getting the effects that we need. So please look over my testimony, and because I think that seeing some of these recent media articles shows that the media is kind of beginning to shine a light that, hey, everyone's been jumping on this bandwagon, but now I think the bandwagon has fallen apart because they're taxing too much and they're not using the funds properly.
Thank you very much. Questions for this panel? Gentlemen, thank you. We appreciate your testimony. Adele Adams, Katie King, Josh, boy, I'm going to mess this one up, Valak, and Caleb Hayes. Please, ladies.
Good morning, Chair Barnhart, Vice Chairs Bailey and Berger, and members of the committee. My name is Adele Adams, and I'm here today representing Multnomah County. I work in the Tobacco Prevention and Education section of the County Health Department. I'm going to try and speed this up by not repeating what we've heard today. So the tobacco tax increase of $1.50 is certainly a public health win, as making tobacco more expensive is a public health best practice to reduce youth initiation and use and to help people quit. The recent Surgeon General's report, The Health Consequences of Smoking, 50 Years of Progress, clearly states that the evidence is sufficient to conclude that increasing the prices of tobacco products, including those resulting from excise tax increases, prevent initiation of tobacco use, promote cessation, and reduce the prevalence and intensity of tobacco use among youth and young adults. In this particular report, there were key conclusions providing evidence that calls for dramatic action to be taken instantly. It states that the endgame strategies are currently being developed, and so 7 actions should be implemented immediately. I'm going to highlight 2 of those. For now, the 7 are included in the testimony that I provided with you. The first one being raising the average excise cigarette tax to prevent youth from starting smoking and encouraging current smokers to quit. The second one is fully funding comprehensive statewide tobacco control programs at CDC recommended funded levels. The report also explains that the evidence-based tobacco control interventions that are effective continue to be underutilized and implemented at far below recommended CDC funding levels. Implementing tobacco control policies and programs as recommended by the United States Health and Human Services and the Institute of Medicine on a sustained basis at high intensity would accelerate the decline of tobacco use in youth and young adults and also accelerate the progress toward the goal of ending the tobacco epidemic. Multnomah County is one of the 34 local health departments charged with protecting the public's health and preventing the spread of chronic diseases in local communities throughout Oregon. Sadly, tobacco use remains the leading cause of preventable death in Oregon. In Multnomah County alone,
right,
over 220...
Of course, you're aware that we have your testimony.
Yes.
Right.
So just highlighting the cost of, in just Multnomah County alone, I know it was touched on slightly earlier, but just for Multnomah County, $223 million is spent each year on medical-related costs. And then another $195 million in productivity is lost due to tobacco-related illness and early death. So please remember that nearly 90% of smokers start before the age of 18, and nearly no one starts smoking at the age of 25. So it's imperative that we implement strategies that prevent youth from smoking and help people quit. Dedicating a portion of House Bill 4129, $1.50 tax, to tobacco prevention education programs will help to fund interventions that will do just that.
Thank you.
Chair Barnhart and members of the committee, my name's Katie King, and I'm here today representing the Coalition of Local Health Officials. And the coalition includes all 34 local health departments. And I would like to say me too, and the coalition supports this bill along with amendments that would dedicate a percentage of the tax increase revenues to local public health prevention programs, and that will help promote some broader collaboration to do the prevention work with CCOs. So thank you very much for your time, and I'm happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. Questions for this panel? Thank you. I will simply note that you and the Taxpayers Association agree on that one point, and that's useful to know. Please.
Good morning, Chair Barnhart, members of the committee. My name is Caleb Hayes. I'm here on behalf of the National Association of Social Workers, and there are 1,800 members here in Oregon. First, I'm going to tell you why I'm here. Second, I'm going to do a couple Me Toos, and then I'm going to reiterate one more point. We'll make it quick. I'm here because, as defined in our Code of Ethics, the primary mission of a social worker is to enhance human well-being and ensure that the basic human needs are provided to every member of our community, with specific emphasis on those who are vulnerable, oppressed, and living in poverty. I'd like to echo the statements of Representative Kenny Geyer, Representative Klim, and Senator Steiner Hayward. They did an excellent job. I hate testifying after them because they take all my good points, but I'm going to reiterate one more. Many smokers are in poverty. One might make the argument that taxing something they are addicted to would hurt those in poverty, but this simply isn't the case. This tax goes toward preventative care and mental health, subsequently to programs that help people quit smoking and lift families out of poverty. I urge your support. Thank you.
Thank you.
Chair Barnhart, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Josh Ballack, representing the Coalition for a Healthy Oregon. These are eight organizations who work with our eight coordinated care organizations across the state. First off, Coalition for a Healthy Oregon just supports this policy in order to help people quit smoking. Believe that that's the most appropriate way. Raising the actual cost will result in people reducing to start smoking. But also, we're very pleased to see that this would be dedicated to help pay for preventative and primary care. There are some really innovative programs that are starting to pop up around the state through the CCOs. I think one in Chair Barnhart's backyard down at Bethel School District, where their Trillium Health Plan is helping train teachers to teach what's known as the Good Behavior Game, which is a in the grade schools. Basically, it's just a program to teach kids how to do, think about consequences. And they've seen through other studies that when kids go through this Good Behavior Game, they reduce their likelihood of using drugs or starting smoking by 50 to 90%. And so the CCO has actually gone out and partnered up with the schools and now starting to spread to other schools. These are the type of innovative programs that this type of funding increase could actually put on steroids and be able to spread across our state. All the evidence shows that the number one, one of the best ways to help reduce smoking and get people to quit is through the patient-provider relationship. By giving more funds to the CCOs to help encourage that, you're going to end up seeing an overall reduction. So with that, we really appreciate you guys taking the time to hear this bill, and we urge a passage of this bill.
Thank you very much. Questions for this panel? I'll simply note that good behavior idea that you're talking about does a whole lot more than deal with just drug addiction. It reduces high school and middle school fights and produces adults who are less likely to commit crimes as they're older. So people who learn how to deal with disputes and disagreements in a socially proactive way generally work better as adults.
The good behavior game has become so popular that literally teachers are flocking to it, saying, "Hey, yeah. Us too, please do it." So I think there's proof's in the pudding. So
thank you very much. Thank you, gentlemen. We appreciate it. We've completed our list for this bill, and so we'll close the public hearing on House Bill 4129. Colleagues, you finished 2 days' worth of work in one day, so tomorrow will be a short day. We will be receiving the revenue estimate. Please be here on time, 8 o'clock for that, so that we can get that done and get you on it with your morning. And with that, the committee is adjourned.